Thanks for the privilege for inviting me. And well, today I'm going to talk about this quite long title, which I deliberately made a little bit long because this is meant to think about. It's the emergence of a background from background independent choreography. And I will be telling you what kind of background it will be in context of two-dimensional quantum gravity, since I will be doing analytical calculations and staying in two dimensions gives me the opportunity to do that. This work was done together with Jan Ambjörn, Ronald Janik, Stefan Zorn, and was recently published in Phys Letters. And so, I will show an exact calculation in background-independent quantum gravity, where a semi-classical geometry appears from the path integral. Well, and in which sense semi-classical, I will explain you later, because it's a bit funny, because in two dimensions we don't really have a Planck length. But it turns out, nevertheless, that we can define a certain semi-classical limit, meaning that we will have a geometry with small fluctuations coming out of the evaluation of the path integral. Well, in four dimensions, there recently have also been calculations coming from causal dynamical triangulations, where geometry emerges from the path integral. But in four dimensions, we have to resort to Monte Carlo simulations. Whereas in this talk, I will be presenting analytical work. So, two-dimensional quantum gravity. Well, some people think it's a bit of a null model. There's not so much there. Namely, there are no local degrees of freedom, but there is some non-trivial information in two-dimensional quantum gravity, namely the dynamics of the model will be governed by the conformal anomaly. Well, so classically, we don't have any real dynamics, but the conformal anomaly will give us some dynamics.
You're talking about 1 plus 1 or
2 plus 1? 1 plus 1, yes. One space dimension, one time dimension. Well, this will become clearer in a moment when you see the pictures and stuff like that. Why do I work in two dimensions? Well, one of the benefits is that it is exactly soluble. And it is a playground for diffeomorphism invariant and background independent theories. And one of the games we can play is trying to incorporate topology changes. Well, that's what I did in some works a while ago, and we obtained a partial result that we could put some over all topologies, so essentially summing over all genera, but with some restrictions. But I won't go into those details. And another reason to be interested in two-dimensional quantum gravity is its relation to string theory. Because string theory is essentially nothing but two-dimensional quantum gravity coupled to matter fields. And recently we have been working on this subject, because we are approaching this from a causal perspective. So right now we're doing calculations. We're trying to couple scalar fields to causal two-dimensional quantum gravity. I will be talking about this hopefully sometime in the future. And what are the natural amplitudes we're after? Well, essentially we're doing two-dimensional quantum gravity in the proper time gauge. And the amplitudes that we want to calculate. So this is the amplitude, the G. G stands here for generating function, but okay. And the arguments are X, Y, and T. Well, what's X? X is the boundary cosmological constant at what I call the entrance loop. Y is the boundary cosmological constant at the exit loop. And T is the temporal extension here. And so what are x and y? Well, essentially they're the conjugate variables of the boundary lengths. So if we want to calculate amplitudes, we essentially have got two different possibilities. We can either fix the boundary lengths, or we can fix the boundary cosmological constants. And this is just a different representation on essentially the same physics, but they are different coordinates, of course. And these are called cylinder amplitudes for the obvious reason. So how do we calculate those amplitudes? Well, there are essentially two approaches on the market. One by Ryuichi Nakayama, and he did a proper time gauge calculation of polygons induced action. And what is this action? Well, this action comes from integrating the conformal anomaly. So it's this conformal anomaly I talked about in the introduction, and also mentioned in the talk earlier, also called the trace anomaly. And another way to calculate this is by using CDT methods, or causal dynamical triangulations. I'll explain you in a moment what causal dynamical triangulations are and what it kind of method is. And loosely said, it's trying to obtain these propagators from a continuum limit of a lattice regularization. And in this lattice regularization, we have a definite notion of causality built in. And these calculations agree perfectly. So what is CDT? Well, usually we have a path integral. And we want to quick rotate it, so to convert this path integral to a statistical mechanics problem. So we want to calculate partition functions. Well, and since we are in 2D, we have full analytical control over all the lattices. And that means that already on the discrete side, we can calculate everything exactly. And then we can also take the continuum limits. So what do we do? Well, we're trying to we approximate the surfaces by gluing identical building blocks. But in the case of two dimensions, those are triangles. Well, here there's some PowerPoint fluke. This should be show the deficit angles here, and that's the way we incorporate non-trivial geometry by putting in defects like this. So this is a flat geometry, a piece of a flat geometry, and this is a piece of a curved geometry, and we obtain this one from this one by removing one triangle. So you can see this is curved. Well, in taking the continuum limit, you directly see that this will give you, this won't give you regular geometries. So these in CDT, the triangulations are not meant to really discretize smooth geometries. It's a path integral approach, and the typical geometries appearing in the path integral are by no means regular. But that's familiar from also the quantization of the non-relativistic particle. So, here you have this amplitude again. But now, with small x and small y, and those small x and small y are the discrete boundary cosmological constants. So, a typical amplitude looks like this. So you build up some discretization of a certain geometry, and it has a specific slicing, and this slicing precisely makes it a causal dynamical triangulation. And in principle, we're working in the Euclidean sector, but precisely the slicing enables us to also do the recurtation afterwards. And I hope this is a bit self-explanatory that here n is the number of triangles, and g is the weight for each triangle. and x and y's are essentially the weights for the boundary edges. And in the gluing, we kind of remove all the x's and y's that are here. So in the end, we just keep the boundary cosmological constants at the boundaries.
Sorry, since you're talking about the weak rotation, so where is the interpretation?
Well, we don't do the weak rotation as of yet. I mean, we're working in the Euclidean sector.
Okay, but at the end of the day, so the question is, what is the interpretation of this object you can create from the point of view of the Lorentzian?
Well, this would be the amplitude. So the propagator.
With respect to which Hamiltonian?
The Hamiltonian will come with respect to the quantum Hamiltonian.
But in gravity, which Hamiltonian? I mean, a priori, that's the whole problem. If you have a cosmological, for instance, universe.
Yeah.
No greater notion of Hamiltonian.
No, in the Hamiltonian, I can write down the Hamiltonian because it's not included in this presentation. So it's a Hamiltonian, it's essentially just a quantum mechanical Hamiltonian in terms of L. So it's L squared.
So I guess my question is more like in 2D it's okay because essentially your theory is equivalent to UV, and then in UV theory it doesn't prefer that Hamiltonian. But let's say if you want to extend this approach to
3D,
or 4D, then what would be the meaning of?
Well, it's the Hamiltonian that corresponds to the proper time gauge. So essentially, what we're doing are proper time gauge calculations. So you can, in this gauge, you can calculate the Hamiltonian with respect to the two-dimensional metric in the three-dimensional case. And with respect to the three-dimensional metric in the 3+1 dimensional case. So it would be that kind of a Hamiltonian.
So the Hamiltonian constraint integrating with the constant lapse?
Yes. Precisely. Having these triangulations, we can take the continuum limit. And that means tuning this the weight for these triangles to 1/2, and which essentially means picking a certain value for the cosmological constant, and the number of triangles goes to infinity.
Little g is related to the cosmological constant.
Yeah, little g was here. Little g is e to the minus lambda times the volume of a triangle. So it's just the weight of one individual triangle. The critical point of the weight is 1/2, n goes to infinity, and we scale the size of the triangle such that the total volume and the boundary lengths are finite. And we just have canonical scaling in the sense that the volume of the triangles goes with a squared, and the boundary length scales with a, and where a is the cutoff, essentially measuring the size of these triangles. And as you can see here, this is how we get big x's from the small x's by this exponential here. Okay, so these are the results. So we can calculate those amplitudes, and you can see that we always have t corresponding to t. We always have the square of lambda because that's the only length scale we have in our problem. So t's and l's are all, or t's and x's are always accompanied by square of lambdas, and these are the two. Essentially the two main different amplitudes we can calculate. Having these amplitudes, we can calculate observables. So what kind of observables do we want to calculate? Well, the typical observables are observables like this. Namely, the average length at a time t, or the average length to some power at this time t, to calculate correlations. So here we have the same picture again, the time, and x, y here, the boundary cosmological constants, And this is like a spatial slice of a one-dimensional universe. So we can calculate the expectation value of the size of our one-dimensional universe, essentially. That's what we're calculating. And another interesting observable to calculate are the fluctuations. And well, I will show you in a bit more detail in a couple of slides. So first, we calculate the amplitude from at a time from time zero to time just a little t, and then we can see what L of t is as a boundary condition to this amplitude. And well, then we glue on top of that the next amplitude, which has an argument t minus t, and which also has a length L of t. And then as step three, we normalize our amplitude. So symbolically, we can write it down kind of like this. OK, so what does our quantum geometry typically look like? Well, the quantum geometry essentially is just fluctuations. Because classically, the system just wants to go to minimal surface. So there are no classical equations of motion. So that's why it's here in the quotation marks. But in the action just wants to minimize the volume, essentially, since we only have a cosmological constant in the action. Because the two-dimensional curvature, if you integrate it, is trivial in two dimensions. So the only action we have is an action proportional to the volume, so governed by the cosmological constant. And the classical solution is just this. So we start with a certain loop, and just one stop here, and ending with a loop. But quantum mechanically, we've got all kinds of fluctuations, and one can calculate in the manner I showed you before. Yeah.
Why is there only one classical solution that is the length? Why do you not have closed topology also, like a circle?
Of course, you can also consider other topologies, but we're considering the cylinder topology at the moment. But of course, you can consider other topologies too.
But should there not be like in between? Should it not occur in the sum? This intermediate space when you do the gas integral.
What kind of state do you mean?
That you don't just have a piece of length, but that you also have some different topology.
Yeah, that would be incorporating topology changes.
Yes. Okay, so you have not done that.
Well, no, I'm not talking about topology change at the moment. I'm just talking about fixed cylinder topology and also fixed spatial topology at each time. So that's important in the model. And if you relieve this constraint in a certain manner, then you get into the universality class of Euclidean dynamical triangulations. So there, that has definitely been studied. And as I mentioned, also space-time topology changes, I tried to incorporate it in a previous model. OK, so now just cylinder topology and just fluctuations, and we can see that the fluctuations are as big as the average. So we don't have any semi-classical geometry whatsoever. So what do we do to get an emergent geometry out? Well, that's what we discovered a new trick, maybe. What's the new trick? Well, we tune this boundary cosmological constant of the exit loop. I hope you remember that was y. We tune it to minus square root lambda. Well, what does this mean? Well, typically, the system, the fluctuations of the boundary of the system are governed by the induced boundary cosmological constant. So in the bulk, we have a lambda, this cosmological constant, and that naturally induces a square root lambda cosmological constant on the boundary. And if we now explicitly tune our boundary cosmological constant in the action to cancel this induced boundary cosmological constant, then there's no weight for the boundary anymore in the path integral. And that means that it wants to expand to infinity. And that's also what happens. So we can calculate explicitly what the average length at this length t is. And we can see that if we tune y to minus squared lambda, then the boundary length diverges.
So you have to, this is a sort of regularization to make things understand. So you're tuning this because this regularizes your expansion?
We're tuning the y is essentially a probe for our theory. It's fixing the boundary. It's fixing the boundary, the boundary conditions. So either you can say I choose to calculate a correlator which has got a fixed L1 here and a fixed L2 there. But the kind of correlator we want to calculate now is with a zero length here and a fixed boundary cosmological constant there. Well, and now it turns out that if you tune the boundary cosmological constant to minus square lambda, you get this diverging behavior. Does this answer your question?
Yeah.
OK, we can talk afterwards, perhaps. OK, so this mechanism is similar to non-critical string theory, where the term that's coined there is ZZ brains. And there also, for a critical value for the binary cosmological constant, there is a transition from compact to non-compact surfaces.
ZZ stands for Zamolodchikov?
Yeah, for the Zamolodchikovs. Yeah, precisely. OK, so to make things a bit more clear, this is what we're calculating. L1, is so the in-length is 0. And we want to calculate the length of a spatial universe at a certain time. And we tune y to its critical value so that the boundary length diverges and the typical geometry in the quantum ensemble becomes non-compact. But we have got two different choices for putting in the boundary conditions at the boundary loop, because we can straight away put y equal to minus squared lambda, or we can first calculate what the critical length is if we plug in y equals to minus squared lambda, and then take the limit t to infinity, the big T, so the system size to infinity. Or we can just tune y. So those are the two situations. So y equal to minus squared lambda, or first tuning L to its critical value, which you calculate before. And so those are the two situations. So, and it turns out that if you calculate the average length, then just the average length, lengths, they match. So they're the same. But the fluctuations are not. So these are two different boundary conditions, which also induce some different physics. OK, so in the further part, we're going to tune the length to its critical value. So what do we get if we actually do the calculations? Well, it turns out that the average length at a time small t is equal to sine hyperbolic. And this pi we fix by comparing to continuum calculations. So this is an overall scaling ambiguity you always obtain when going from a discrete theory to a continuum theory. And by continuum calculations, we match this. And so what do we what does this mean? Well, this means that we really obtain the metric for a hyperbolic plane, and the hyperbolic plane is a surface, a Euclidean surface of constant negative curvature, and we get precisely from this, and so this is the metric we get, where this theta is the angular variable, where we added the pi factors here to welcome to show it in the canonical form. Well, and another surprising thing is that if we calculate the fluctuations, the relative fluctuations become small. So here you can see the relative fluctuations, so delta L over L dampens out with e to the minus square root lambda t. So from the origin, here we have big fluctuations, and then after the times much bigger than 1 over square root lambda, the fluctuations just become smaller, smaller, and smaller. So this is really something like a semi-classical geometry, where the parameter for semi-classicality is not the Planck length, but is governed by square root lambda. This is what sets the fundamental length. And if we progress to times much bigger than square root, 1 over square root lambda, we get small fluctuations. So we have something like emergent geometry. Well, which emergent geometry? The hyperbolic plane. And why can we call it emergent geometry? Well, because we have small fluctuations. We really have a Poincaré metric, and we can calculate that the fluctuations are small. So that's very nice. So, but what about the local structure? Do these fluctuations are locally small? Do we have fluctuating regions, or what is the local structure? Because until now we only have global information, namely we just have the total length. Well, that's of course because of diffeomorphism invariance, but it turns out you can interpret this in terms of local fluctuating areas and elements. And well, one way to see it is that, well, the number of line elements is essentially the number of 1 over square root lambdas. So those are kind of the fundamental regions. But these are the fundamental spatial regions. And in a moment, we will also calculate temporal correlations. And then we can really make the interpretation of locally fluctuating patches of space-time. So why are they independent? Well, it's the familiar 1 over square root n law we can calculate. So if we use this definition I gave you in the previous slide for n, then we can calculate also the relative fluctuations of the number of these regions at a certain time. And this neatly gives us the 1 over square root n law. So that means they are really independent patches of space, so to say. So whether we also have independent space-time regions, for that we have to calculate space-time correlations. So how do we do that? Well, that's applying the same procedure as I explained to you in the beginning, but then a bit more complicated, namely, we have to fix two lengths at a time small t and a time small t plus delta. And where delta here measures is in fact the correlation time. So until now, we only calculated the spatial correlations. Now we also calculate temporal correlations. But of course, the results will be for the critical case, so where we fix the boundary length to be in the critical regime. So in the non-critical case, we get a kind of a complicated dependence on this correlation time delta. Well, as you can see, it looks a bit messy. And well, it's hard interpreting this. But some nice coincidences happen if we tune to the critical case. But in the critical case, for the temporal correlations, we get a result like this. So where there's no delta dependence anymore. So there's no dependence on the correlation time delta. But that's kind of funny. So are these things then perfectly correlated? Because that's in principle what it says. If we don't have a dependence on this correlation time delta, it means that the correlations are perfectly correlated. So if one thing moves, then the other thing moves simultaneously. That's what it means. But recall that, that we had this interpretation of small regions. And, well, essentially, the number of regions increases exponentially. Because we had this space-time that exponentially expanded, essentially with the sine hyperbolic. And so the number of elements also increases exponentially. So now the fact that the space-time correlations of these of the total lengths led us to believe that the correlation length of these individual regions fall off exponentially to cancel precisely this exponential growth here. So that's the interpretation one should have. So they're not only independent in space because of the 1 over square root n law, but they are also not really correlated temporally because of the exponential decrease of the correlations in time. So now we really have the picture of our universe, which is fluctuating fluctuating randomly, and which has a constant curvature background, and the fluctuations are really locally fluctuating space-time patches. Yes?
I just don't understand the logic. If I have a spin system at high temperature, so
yes,
that I have a large number of systems of the size of the correlation length, and I now consider correlation functions in time in the same region, they're also uncorrelated.
Yes.
If I go far enough away, if I wait long enough, they're uncorrelated.
Of course, but it depends on the type of correlations you have. If you exponentially decaying correlations, then they're not really correlated. If you've got correlations that go as a power law, then they really have some genuine correlations. This is reminiscent of Gaussian correlations. I mean, you're essentially probing the tail of Gaussian. So that means independent.
Yeah, the fact that it's like a 1 over square root n is entirely classical of this random.
Yeah, but those are two factors, right? We have the 1 over square root n, and we've got the exponential fall off in time. So that's the 1 over square root of n is in the same spatial slice, and the dying out exponential are the temporal correlations. So these two things together show that you can view it as independently space-time patches. But because we are in a specific gauge, we cannot really probe that information fully. But we can at least get this interpretation like this.
Okay, so I don't care. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yes. I guess the question, I have a similar confusion. Maybe can you phrase the question? The fact that there's correlation in time or not, can you phrase in terms of your Hamiltonian? The question is whether the Hamiltonian you're looking at has a mass gap or not. So what is the answer to that? Is it gapless or is it gap?
It's gap.
It's gap.
Yeah, it's essentially the harmonic oscillator. It's got a harmonic oscillator spectrum.
So if you say it's gap, it's...
Any other questions? Okay. Then, well, I give my summary. Well, what have I explained to you? Well, I have explained to you a fully analytical calculation where the hyperbolic plane, addressed with small fluctuations, emerges from an exact and background-independent evaluation of the two-dimensional path interval. So, something to take home is that the I want you to feel that CDT is an excellent tool to study the emergence of backgrounds from background-independent quantum gravity. So thank you for your attention.
and you last three more. I mean, I think I would tame down a bit these things. This is a 2D gravity, there's two features, which makes it very different. Because there's no fundamental landscape. There's no contract, and you mentioned that. But the second thing is that it's a...
Well, there is a fundamental, there is a cosmological scale. Okay.
There's no contract. So there's a, there's no minimum, that's maximum. But the second thing is that you say it's background independent, but if you look at the theory in the continuum, you know that the dynamic of the theory is completely fixed by the Liouville theory, which is a purely background dependent theory, right? Because of the conformal anomaly. You have a flat space metric, you have a field living on it, and then you can study the dynamics of Liouville theory on this auxiliary space. So 2D.
No, that's a specific point of view. I mean, this calculation is fully background independent. I mean,
it is, but the theory you're looking at, you know that it's interacting field theory on flat space.
That's an equivalent formulation. So but it doesn't mean that this evaluation is not background independent. Because if you would say that this is not background independent, then you would say, well, this whole dynamical triangulation approach is not is background dependent. Well, then you should show me the background. I can see the background.
Well, I guess it's kind of hidden. In the sense, it's maybe back to my first question when I was saying which Hamiltonian do you choose? So you say, I take the proper time Hamiltonian. Now I know that in 2D, the proper time Hamiltonian is definitely positive because it's Liouville Hamiltonian. But this is not going to be true in 3D or 4D. That is, if I look at the proper time Hamiltonian, which is the integral of the constraint, then it is unbounded from below or above. So I guess, I think, well, as long as what you're saying is restricted to 2D, it's absolutely perfectly fine.
Well,
if you want to, you know.
In principle, all what I'm saying is restricted to 2D.
Yes.
But the way we get the Hamiltonian has also got a very definite, there's also a very definite procedure to get the Hamiltonian in 3D. And Dami Benedetti is working on that.
With the medium Hamiltonian, the proper time Hamiltonian.
Yeah, that's a proper time Hamiltonian.
Is it a positive Hamiltonian?
Well, the calculations haven't been finished yet. So at the moment, it's not quite clear, but I think you have to discuss it with Dario, but I think at the moment it looks...
No, but it's a classical question. I think there's results of the 80s that look at the Hamiltonian proper time gauge.
Yeah, okay, but this would be the quantum Hamiltonian.
Which shows that it's not positive.
But this would directly calculate the quantum Hamiltonian. So bypassing the classical thing, because we're directly calculating the quantum Hamiltonian. So whatever issues arise in the classical Hamiltonian, we just are insensitive to that. We don't know exactly. We can only directly calculate the quantum Hamiltonian. So. Yeah, whatever Hamiltonian you get, you then have to compare back with continuum methods. And I think at the moment it's not quite clear yet how this is going to work. But it seems that one gets a similar Hamiltonian to the 2D case. So where not the length of the universe is the basic variable in the Hamiltonian, but where the area is the basic variable in the Hamiltonian. So you get a quantum mechanical model where the area is the basic variable of the quantum mechanics. So that's what comes out. And then, well, what kind of spectrum it has and other questions, the propagator, that's still really under investigation. So we get the Hamiltonian, my statement of that it's equivalent to quantum gravity in a proper time gauge, that's a thing that we can say with hindsight. I mean, we have a proper time gauge calculation and we have got a CDT calculation. And then it turns out they match perfectly. And this match still has to be made in the 3D case. But it turns out to be, it seems to look similar. But for details, you have to ask Dario. He is working on that at the moment. Any other questions?
So if not, let's thank Gregory.